CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, Hotel Mars. Episode N, David Livingston, Dr. Space himself of The Space Show is here, my colleague and co-host and co-pilot. And we're looking to the future and power needs on planet Earth. Renewables are adequate. However, the real renewable is the most important star in the cosmos. That's our sun. We watch it for sunspots. We watch it for beach activity. We certainly watch it to sustain our life. Can we watch it for energy? David and I are very happy to welcome John Mankins. He's the author of the forthcoming new second edition of The Case for Space Solar. John, a very good evening to you. This is exciting. David is way ahead of me. He's talked about this for some time. I have not. So we do some definitions, John. What is space solar? What does that mean? What does it describe? Good evening to you.
A very good evening to you. So space solar power is the idea of harvesting solar energy in space near the Earth, where the intensity of sunlight is some 40% greater than the intensity on this on a clear summer day here on Earth, because there's no atmosphere, and then transforming that solar energy in space into electrical power, and from electrical power into radio frequency energy, and then transmitting it in a coherent, low-intensity beam from space to markets here on Earth. That's it.
Wow. David?
John, how technologically ready are we to do this today? So professionally, I would ask you what your TRL is, but are we capable of doing this, or do we still need innovation?
So unlike other really breakthrough energy ideas, like, for example, fusion, the basic physics of solar power satellites, i.e. the systems that would do space solar power, have been around since the 1960s. So all the basic physical discoveries have been made for decades. And during the past 40 or 50 years, it's really just been a question of the cost, the economics of the systems. So we've been at the level of physics and laboratory demonstrations, even some field demonstrations, for many, many years. And now it's just in the last 10 years that we've moved to the point where the technologies to make the costs manageable are at hand. So we're very much ready to go.
I'm looking right now at a write-up in Science Magazine having to do with cost, but I want to focus on the infrastructure here. What I'm looking at in your excellent book is a diagram of a satellite, an elaborate affair. It looks something like a blooming daffodil, and it's to catch the sun's rays, and that I take it at some point, it beams it down to Earth. And this would be in geosynchronous orbit, so it would always be at the same place. What is receiving it on Earth? I understand the sunlight, the solar, the beam, but what does it hit down there, John?
So a wonderful man by the name of William Brown, who worked at Raytheon Corporation back in the 1950s, invented a device known as a rectifying antenna. It's basically a small antenna, looks like a T. And at the base of the T, or inside the two halves of the base of the T, there's a single diode. And this antenna takes an incoming radio wave and converts it into direct current. And so what the receiver would look like on Earth for a solar power satellite transmission would look like a large mesh antenna covered with these small T's, these small rectifying antennas. So it'd be a large mesh, would be up above the ground. When you were underneath of it, you'd see sunlight and sky and clouds overhead. But you'd also see this mesh, sort of like being in a pergola in your backyard, but made of wire, like a chain link fence, cyclone fencing. And on top of the fencing, there would be these T's, the individual antennas of the rectifying antenna, the rectenna. The total area, normally, because it is hot, lots of power, but at low intensity, would be on the order of 3 or 4 miles across. The antenna would be flat, and it would be up above your head by, say, 15 or 20 feet. So you, underneath, you could have farmlands, you could have desert, it could be over ocean or offshore, and it would be about 4 miles or so in diameter.
And this power coming down, I read from the write-up, is not strong. So it would not hurt birds, it would not hurt insects, it would not hurt anything, any creature that we can imagine getting in the way solar panels or windmills do.
Yeah, so the peak power intensity at the very center of the receiver would be 200 watts or so per square meter. A meter is a little bit larger than a yard, so a square yard, a little bit larger than a square yard. Summer sunlight, like you went out on a clear summer day and looked at the sun, and you were in the Sahara Desert, you'd see about 1,000 watts per square meter. At the peak of the rectenna, a bird flying through might experience maybe 200 watts, so about 20%, one-fifth of sunlight's energy. And it's very long wavelengths. It can't. It cannot cause any damage. Birds won't be set on fire. Insects can just fly right through. And on the edges of the beam, it would be down around 2 watts, so about 1% of the center.
David, you have a question.
John, would you store the power when it's nighttime where the rectenna is located, or does it need to have sunlight all the time? How does that work at nighttime?
So the solar power satellite in a geostationary Earth orbit is going to see the sun 99.95% of the year. So it can provide the energy from space 24/7, 365. However, in the spring, right around March 20th, and in the fall, right around September 20th, there are these things called the equinoxes. And that's when the Earth and the Sun line up with geostationary Earth orbit. And for about a maximum of about an hour, a little more, the satellite would be in the shadow of the Earth at midnight on that day, and a little bit less, a little bit less, a little bit less during the preceding week and the following week. So during the equinox, you do have to have a battery, but the battery is only for about an hour, a little longer, and it would be at midnight when the demand for power is at a minimum. And the rest of the year, 99.95% of the year, you can have power whenever you want it, rain or shine, winter or summer, whenever.
Gigawatts. What is the estimate of what you could produce with one satellite of gigawatts for eager customers?
So between 1,000 and 2,000 megawatts, between 1 and 2 gigawatts. And that would represent between 1 and 2 million homes.
I see. So we're looking at a constellation then of sun-catching satellites that would be in geosynchronous orbit. Just as said, I'm trying to think of them as Starlink, the constellation that passes over my head for internet. That's what it would look like for...
Well, except of course, much farther away and much larger. And whereas the constellation of Starlink satellites is moving across the sky constantly, these would be fixed in the sky because they'd be in a geostationary Earth orbit. They would just, when you looked at them, the apparent location in space in the sky would always be the same.
David?
So this sounds like the ultimate Green New Deal source of energy for the grid, yet the U.S. government is not very supportive of it. Some other governments are. Why is it not catching on other than in commercial space markets and advocates and conference people that you talk with and that I talk with?
Well, back in the day, this was initially studied in the 1970s. And using the technologies of the mid-1970s, think about where computers were. You know, like an 8-bit computer was a marvel. The TRS-80, the first, you know, portable computer, personal computer, hadn't even been developed yet. The technologies didn't permit automation or advanced robotics. Materials were still very heavy. The construction infrastructure for these systems was designed in concept and was projected to cost hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars in 1979. And because of these, to get to the first kilowatt hour, because of these massive costs, at that time, the project in the U.S. was canceled. And it's only been more recently that with advances in solid-state electronics, that back in the 1970s, it would have all been done with vacuum tubes. Remember old-style TVs with the vacuum tubes glowing in the back? Now it's all solid-state and flat screen, and none of that was true in the mid-1970s. It was all, you know, astronauts with torches and wrenches. Now you can do it with automation and robotics and modular systems and plug and play. But there's many, many people in the American space program, and many of them at NASA, who remember very well the way it used to be. And it's very hard to get out of what you know well when you are a senior person in your field. I believe that you've talked before about the cost of access to space, dollars per kilogram.
Right.
I was at NASA in the 1990s when the reusable launch vehicle program was there to try to pursue that. And NASA came to a conclusion in the early 2000s that lowering the cost of launch was impossible. That lower cost launch was for the indefinite future, and all we could try to do was build heavy lift launch to do our exploration missions. And it wasn't until the private sector, SpaceX, Blue Origin, and others, started actually building low-cost reusable launchers that suddenly it became a fact. And that's actually been only 9 years ago that the first reusable booster flew, the Falcon 9 reusable, and now it's a matter of fact. Everybody knows low-cost launch is not only achievable, it's inevitable. The same thing, I think, is true with space solar power. There's so many years of experience that have educated people to know that space solar power is expensive because it would have been in 1980.
John Mankins is the author of The Case for Space Solar Power. It's available at Amazon right now. David Livingston, Dr. Space of The Space Show. John has agreed to play a game with us now when we come back. We're going to give him an unlimited budget, and that means as many starships and super heavies as he wants. And we're going to build the future. This is CBS Eye on the World, Hotel Mars, Episode N. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.